At this time, we are going to go into our question and answer. Teresa, where are you?
I'm right here. I'll be doing them.
Skidmark Bob is going to be over here in this microphone. And we ask you to make your question short and succinct and make it a question. Thank you. Here's Michael to answer your question.
All right, first person.
And let's just make it the people who are lined up now, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I thought there was more. Yeah, go ahead.
My name's Jeff, and I simplify the Power Corrupts, Founding Fathers. I repeat this, however correct. The Founding Fathers said, warned us against the powerful, but we've been worshiping the powerful. In fact, we worship the Founding Fathers. And so have you ever looked at the psychology of why the followers, something in their brain and something in the being led, the powerful are addicted to power and the followers addicted to worshiping, and those two things feed each other?
Yeah, I've dealt with that in a book called Power and the Powerless, in my other book called Super Patriotism, too, how people are manipulated, black shirts and reds. What much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. So the symbols may be irrational. Let's take Nazi Germany. There were all sorts of symbols about blood and Aryan folk power and Macht and this and that. And these were irrational symbols. But they were very consciously, rationally manipulated, directed towards certain publics and such. And so you could see people get misled. People often cannot make history. They're too busy trying to make a living. And so to make history. And yet at times they're capable of extraordinary feats of resistance and enlightenment and not getting taken in. But this is what I was saying at the closing lines of my talk, that there is a tremendous struggle, ideological struggle going on in this country. Just the use of terms, for instance. Look at this thing with Obama. He's being praised, or others are saying, oh, he's not being ideological, he's being practical. That means he's hiring people from Republican administrations. That means you're practical. Some of whom are the biggest ideologues in the world. Everybody has an ideological cast, even if it may not be that well developed at times. So one of the ideological distortions in our society is the preachment that there's no ideology. See? We don't have an ideology. It's you people over there on the left or something. You are the ideologues. We just sort of deal with life as it comes. Well, they're really devoting all their time to this kind of thing. So that's an ancient question in political theory. Why do people abide by the system that exploits them, and how do they accept their own exploitation? Did I answer your question to some degree, or I don't know? Yeah.
Hello. I am always outraged when I hear someone such as yourself speak and when I see what's going on. But it's interesting, I have a 93-year-old mother, and she's, when I talk to her, she worked all her life, and my father, who went to his life, he worked and he did well enough to take care of our family, and they lived through the Depression. And, when I argue with her still about these things, she said, I don't get it, because, we, in the Depression, we were barefoot, we didn't have a meal, and, every day necessarily, it was really bad. And I see people now bitterly complaining about the state of affairs, and yet I see that they all have these big screen TVs, and they all have cell phones, and the kids all have cell phones, and they have nice cars, and you know, I don't see the poverty that I saw in the depression that my family worked through and came out okay. And how do you answer that, something like that? And this kind of argument is used.
I can't give the whole lecture all over again. I mean, I pointed out the cutbacks, the insufficiencies, there's tremendous. There's a tremendous mass consumption society. It still is. I mean, it's a glut of stuff, and that does give a glitter of abundance. And yeah, and so the kid can get a cell phone and the like. And you can get a brain tumor, yeah, I guess, right? But she's just comparing a different kind of poverty. That's what I would say. There's a lot of those people who have cars also have enormous debts of a kind that people in the Depression didn't have. They've got credit card debts. They've got all sorts of other debts. They've got enormous stresses of all kinds. There's tremendous stress in this society. Half the population is on anti-stress medications of some kind, even ones which only make you feel worse, as we were talking about that at dinner tonight. So it's a different kind of poverty. A friend of mine is from the an acquaintance, I don't really remember who he was, from the Dominican Republic. He said when someone was poor and you lost everything in Dominican Republic, you moved in with your uncle. Or you moved into the little shack or the cabin in the back that he wasn't using, and you had a place, there was a little place for you to stay. So that poverty was so simple, and so poverty was so low, and it was so communal, and it wasn't the poverty of a high consumption society. In a high consumption society, when you lose, you really take a tumble. You really go down. You lose your house. You can lose your car. If you lose your car, you can't get around to find a job anymore. It gets desperate, and you end up out on the street. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you might have a family that can take you in, but they may be having as rough a time as you, or near rough. So it's a different kind of poverty, and that's what she doesn't see. She's seeing a lot of consumer prosperity, of which there still is, you know, there still is some level of consumer prosperity. But it's record consumer debt. It's really being pumped up. It's still artificially pumped up. That's what this whole thing with the banks was about. They have all this money and they didn't know where to invest it. When you don't know where to invest it, that's another way of saying there are no markets of consumption. There's no buying power out there. And that's when they started putting these phony empty packages together of subprime mortgages and that kind of stuff. Dora.
Very close. Thank you, Michael. Hey, I have really lots of questions, but I'm going to ask you this one because I'm always confused when people are saying that when jobs are outsourced away from the U.S., that doesn't really affect U.S. workers. And if you could just explain that a little bit, you know, whether it does or doesn't.
Well, it certainly does. Yeah, I said it does affect. You close down, Nike closed down all its stateside factories. General Motors talks about closing down factories. That means massive layoffs of thousands of people. What General Motors doesn't tell you, whenever they announce closing down, they slip in the word every so often, the stateside factory is not. Stateside is the code word. It means in America, you know. But they don't tell you they're opening another factory in Guatemala or in Mexico or in even further off somewhere.
I'm sorry, because a lot of times I've heard economists say things like, well, that doesn't really hurt the economy because somehow outsourced jobs actually make U.S. workers more prosperous and productive.
Yeah, there are economists who are paid to write things like that, that's right, and confuse the rest of us. That's their job to do that, twist it around and turn it around a bit. But it does. I mean, the high-paying blue-collar industry jobs like steel workers, auto workers, they've become more and more scarce. Probably about the only industry left where you can get a good-paying blue-collar job anymore is in defense industry, where you make, you know, they don't, that they still keep at home for security reasons and such. You know, you wouldn't outsource to Russia or China defense jobs. You know, please make me some jet fighters and tanks, and here's the plans for it and all that. No. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to take you a little off track because my ears perked up when the gal who introduced you mentioned an article or something that you had done on Mother Teresa and the fast track saints, and I'm just curious where that can be found.
Well, please just go to my website. I meant to ask her to mention my website. It's just MichaelParenti, one word, .org.
Okay.
And or it's also Michael Parenti's Political Archives if you want to Google. And you go on that, and I still had an icon on the home page. Just go to articles, and it's right in there.
Okay. And I had one question more relevant to your talk.
It's an excerpt from a chapter of this book I've just written about God and religion and all that, which I'm still trying to get published, but yeah.
And just more to the point of what you were talking about, I don't know if you know much about it, but would you talk about... One of the things we're not told is that during the Great Depression, a lot of communities developed their own currency, and I think that's going to become a very relevant piece that we can play in the coming times, and I'm wondering if you know much about that. But there were hundreds of communities, from my understanding.
I don't know if hundreds, but there were a lot. they developed a script, and they limited the number of pieces that were printed up. And they tried to give it a value, and it was a way of, because people were getting into exchanges, you know. I don't have a job, you don't have a job, can you come and fix the plumbing in my basement, and I'll come and paint your house or something. So after a while, what would happen is, they said, well, let's have script for this, and we can buy things at stores and the like. That movement wasn't just the Depression. For a while, it was... It was about 10, 12 years ago, it was coming back here in the U.S., but I haven't heard much about it now. Sorry. Yeah, well, maybe we should. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Alphonse, and I'm a high school teacher. And, you know, I would like to know more or less if you share my opinion, and I suppose that other people's opinion, right, that, you know, the public... education system, all right, is suffering like some kind of attack, let's say it. So it gets watered down, right? So what would be a democratic power of people getting empowered with knowledge, right, is getting watered down. So at the end, you get people who don't have any critical thinking, so who are easy victims to prejudice and to manipulation and indoctrination around how things are. There's nothing you can change, okay? And instead of, you know, having people, you know, with some education, formed critical thinking, okay, then are just, you know, the poor minions that, you know, cannot just leave the situation, you know? You know, I would like to know if you more or less think that that's some kind of attack on the democratic power of education through watering it down.
We mean watering down the education as a way of
as a way of making people who cannot think by themselves,
yeah,
and who cannot critically think about how things are in general.
Yeah, well, there were always two tendencies toward public education. There were those people who wanted public education because they wanted Americans as human beings to have an education, to become self-affirming, to be capable citizens and like. And there were others who saw public education as a means of conditioning and limiting and constraining, taking the hooliganism out of these unwieldy new arrivals and teaching them true Americanism and making sure they're obedient automatons and learn to pledge allegiance and all that. Their presence was felt much more than the presence of the more idealized people who push for public education. And I'm sure today we were talking about that, about the whole No Child Left Behind, getting teachers are teaching to the test, which has a demoralizing effect, and you're not teaching kids how to think anymore, you're just giving them rote memory and the like. And the pushing of drugs on kids in schools and such. Mostly, But mostly the reactionaries don't really see public education as a valuable tool. They want to privatize everything. And so their goal really is to prove that public education doesn't work. And the way you prove that it doesn't work is that you have poor performance. And the way you have poor performance is by you defund it. You don't give it any money, you don't do this, so the kids are sitting there with these ratty old textbooks that are falling apart, the leaks in the ceilings. Jonathan Kozol has written and spoken eloquently about all of that. That's all I got to say about public education.
Do you want one more?
Sure. How about just two more here?
Do you have any solutions to how we can stop outsourcing of jobs? Because I think that is one of the biggest problems of capitalism in this country. The government seems to think that because of free market and free enterprise, that we can't intervene at all.
Yeah, I would say, you know, and it's not such a break for the third world country that gets the job, because they get these jobs under miserable conditions with no occupational safety, no real living wage. They suffer from toxicities. Their land gets destroyed and depleted by the factory that's built there with no environmental regulations. So it's really, outsourcing the job is not any favor to the American worker, nor is it such a great favor to the recipient country. And what can I say but that issue should be really publicized more. You would have the high ground, too, because you could say, you know, America first. It's sort of in a way you can pursue a reformist and progressive goal with some of the usual rah-rah mainstream rhetoric there. You can say these jobs should be here in America. Yeah, we should trade with other countries. Yeah, there should be people working in different places and sharing technologies. I want other countries to be successful and viable. You know, they'll have markets, they'll trade with us, they'll buy our stuff, we'll buy theirs and all that. Maybe we'll all work toward a rational solutions to global warming and the like. None of that's being done really now in any magnitude. So the way to do it is to get the unions on it, for one thing. They should, and some of them are on it, but some of them do surprisingly little about it. One of the things we did was we exposed the export subsidies that the Republicans have been doing. These are the same Republicans who always talk about how they're for America first, and they wear little flags in their lapels, and they're always saluting the flag, and they're waving a flag in your face. But then it turns out they actually were subsidizing companies, giving them startup capital, doing some of their research, outreach research, for when they wanted to move and close down their factory in the U.S. and go move it to some low-wage area somewhere else, abroad. I hope we've stopped the government from supporting outsourcing. That's the first thing you can do. And the second thing you can do is emphasize how there's plenty of labor pools and people ready to work here in this country. You don't have to take these things all the way halfway around the world to make them. You know.
Michael, I'm Terry, and my perspective includes having worked with three White Houses in previous administrations, Reagan, Bush 1, and Clinton. In addition to that, many years prior, I worked for Ralph Nader in my youthful idealism on what became the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. So my perspective on what goes on in Washington is interesting. It's informed to the point where I know how blessed corrupt both the Republicans and Democrats are and have been for at least the last 30 years in the U.S. Congress, including the Clinton White House, which also shipped 3 million U.S. manufacturing jobs largely to China, in exchange for what became contributions to Mr. Clinton's 96 campaign, as it turns out, his library and later his speaking fees at $110 million over the last 8 years. So both administrations, clearly the Bush-Cheney administration was the most corrupt and incompetent simultaneous and the most damaging we've had. With respect to that, would you agree with me that we have not addressed yet a plan for the environmental deteriorations which our species and our national society are inflicting on the planet. We've not addressed the house of cards the U.S. economy is on, and we've not addressed the transition that we must make ecologically as well as a sustainable economy and perhaps in terms of behaving as an ethical culture on the planet.
I would agree with you, yes,
I'm sure
indeed.
You do, and I praise your work. I've read several of your books, and I recommend that I acknowledge and recognize your own insights in this matter. My question focuses on, though, all these people of goodwill, be they in Santa Cruz or San Jose, unless they focus on fixing the political culture in this country that elects political whores and prostitutes in both parties to the U.S. Congress and our state legislatures, and tragically to the highest offices. I remove Mr. Obama from that list. I think he is honest and competent, and hopefully he'll have enough support. But do you agree with me that we must provide him pushes the same way Roosevelt had pushes from the left and the progressives, so he could say to the right-wing reactionaries, I must do this, or we're going to have a serious revolution? And how do you suggest groups like this, people in this room, cohesively make a difference? Should we replace all the incumbent members of Congress and have term-limited people of goodwill who serve for limited terms with no bribery?
No, I'm against term limits. Term limits means you're constantly facing a freshman and sophomore legislature. There's no culture, there's no institutional memory. Sometimes it may take you 12, 13 years to get a bill through Congress. If you got only 8 years, then you don't have a chance at it. And what's happened with term limitation in this state, as you see, nobody settles in the state assembly. These guys are in there and they're just looking for the next hop. They just see it as the next hop. They're not going to make a real 20-year career or commitment out of it. So I don't see term limits as a very good development at all. It's a wrong solution to a real problem, which is how to get these people more responsive to us, and that's the way. And those things, I mean, you know, we've all written about it. We know what to do. The thing is how to get to do it, and that's what I mean about educating and agitating and such. We need to nationalize the costs of elections. They should not be privately funded. Right now, our elections are privately funded. In other words, they're bought by big, rich companies and banks and the like. So we should have, and there are a couple of states that are doing that. The state of Maine, I think, right now, anybody could run for office and get publicly funded equal to your opponents. And that really does have a better effect on who gets elected and what's done and not done. Access to the media, we used to have what was called equal time. Equal time was if one candidate got somewhere, then another would get equal time. And maybe oblige all media, TV, and radio stations to give equal time, because the airwaves are the property of the people of the United States. We could do that. So those would be the things we'd want to do. Yeah. I think that was it, right?
Yeah. Just a second,
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming out, folks. Tune in to Free Radio.
At this point, I'd like to invite all the Free Radio programmers to come up on stage, please. If you're a Free Radio programmer, would you come join me on stage? That means you too, Bob. Mr. Nice Guy. Michael, come join us. Yeah.
Are we going to sing now or what?
No.
Is someone outside?
Teresa's talking. Okay.
Thanks for coming, everyone.
Thanks for coming.
How about a big hand for the hardworking staff here at the Loudon Nelson Center?
Listen to Free Radio, and please, if you can, donate to Free Radio. It's those monthly donations that really keep us going. Thank you. Bye-bye.